All right, next matter is Kevin Antoine Thomas against the Commonwealth, Mr. Anderson, Mr. Jones. Mr. Anderson, would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 3 minutes.
All right, we'll be happy to hear from you when you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. David Anderson on behalf of Mr. Thomas. I would like to first focus on my second assignment of error, which is in regards to the objection that the court sustained by the Commonwealth that asking whether or who the vehicle was registered to was hearsay. It's the appellant's position that...
How could it not be hearsay?
Well, Judge, it's factual information. It's not a statement. It's just factual information that the
factual
officer...
Factual information doesn't take it out of the hearsay realm.
Correct, Your Honor, but it's not a statement. In this case, it was the results of the officer's investigation. Had, say, the owner come up and said that this is my vehicle, and the officer said... The owner told me this was my vehicle. That is a statement. That's not what we have here. What we have here is the officer verifying that this that the registration or through a third-party dispatcher, that
actually,
is not...
Actually, counsel, though, he didn't know how he verified it. Isn't that fair to say?
He knew it was one of those two ways.
But he didn't know how... He knew that it was two options, but he wasn't clear as to how he'd actually done it.
Correct, Your Honor, but it was one of those two ways, or it could have been both, a synthesis of both of those. Either way, it doesn't call for what did so-and-so tell you. It calls for who owned the vehicle.
If that's a fact you're trying to establish, I mean, you're the proponent of the evidence, why not simply introduce a certified copy of the vehicle registration? I mean, that's the proper way to do it.
Had that been available, perhaps. However,
well, why would it not be available? All you got to do is ask DMV for it, or subpoena the information from DMV.
Well, then we come to the issue as to whether or not that was the office. If it was done by the officer, there's no real burden on the.
No, I guess, but maybe I'm not making myself clear. I mean, if the point of you asking the question, or trial counsel asking the question of the officer, is to establish who owns the vehicle. It seems to me if that's the information you want to establish, the proper way to do it, and certainly the bulletproof way to do it, is to introduce a certified copy of the registration as a public record, which, of course, is an exception to the hearsay rule.
Yes, Judge, but what we're saying is that this is not hearsay. With regards to...
Well, why isn't it an out-of-court statement? It's information about the ownership of the vehicle. The officer has no independent knowledge of that other than... what he heard from somewhere else, either the dispatcher or some other source.
I think it's analogous to, say, for instance, when the Commonwealth asked the officer, on such and such date did you come in contact with Kevin Thomas? We don't object to that because...
But that's out of his knowledge. That's his own knowledge.
That's correct, Your Honor. But he had to have found that information out through some way.
Let me give you a hypothetical. If Judge Malveau tells me that she was up... Yeah, she's nervous already. If Judge Malveau tells me that she got up early this morning and noticed that the sun rose in the east, and then I come in here and testify and say, you know, Judge Malveau said the sun rose in the east. Obviously, that's a fact. It's a fact that's easily ascertainable from, you know, from reference to a atlas or, you know, scientific journal, whatever. The point is it's still hearsay because I am... testifying to an out-of-court statement that's presumably being offered for the truth of the matter from another source.
From another declarant. In this case, we don't really have a declarant either because we have the registration.
But if Judge Malveau got on the witness stand and said, hey, I got up early this morning and I saw the sun rising in the east, there's nothing wrong with that statement. She's the declarant.
Correct, Your Honor, and that wouldn't be hearsay. But in this case, we don't have a declarant for the officer to say, so-and-so told me this.
So is your position because there's no definite declarant, then it's not hearsay?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, because it's first of all not a statement. There's no real declarant.
Well, if we have many cases in which a witness tries to testify as to what is in a book on engineering, a book on whatever, health, and that's hearsay, isn't it? It's not. There's no declarant. No one has been permitted to read out of a book except in certain circumstances in which it is proven, as a matter of law, something that one can refer to.
To a certain extent, but we allow all the time sufficiently reliable information to be entered into in evidence, I would argue that this is sufficiently.
Well, reliability is different. I'm trying to understand your conclusion that it's not a statement.
So
even because it is in written form somewhere out there,
not
ostensibly under the DMV records.
Not necessarily that it is in a written form. The
well,
case.
Where is it recorded? Where is this information about ownership? Where is it?
Presumably
in the cloud, I guess.
Presumably by the DMV.
Okay, the DMV has a record of ownership, usually, and that record is what the police officer would have been relying on to answer the question. Would it not have been?
Yes, Your Honor. However, one of the cases that I cite in my brief the Rogers v. Commonwealth, again, it's a unpublished, however, there's nothing else that's directly on point.
Okay.
But that other panel drew that same logical conclusion that the officer saw registration and was able to testify as a result of the result, or as a result of his investigation.
Let's suppose we disagree with your position that this is hearsay. Given the fact that our case law indicates that it's either ownership or occupancy, how is this not harmless?
Well, Your Honor, the jury submitted three questions. Excuse me.
But we can't look at jury questions as it relates to the appeal, can we?
Well, with regards to harmless error, clearly it was something that the fact finder was thinking about when they were evaluating the evidence. So that's what makes it not harmless. Moving on to the sufficiency issue, the appellant contends, as we did at trial, that the defendant simply didn't know that the firearm was there.
Well, that's a factual determination. And so the question is whether there's evidence to support the fact finder's conclusion that he had constructive possession of the weapon. And as I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand this record, when he's stopped by the police for the traffic infraction, he's asked if there's any drugs in the car, and he says there's some marijuana in the console. Well, that certainly is probable cause then to conduct a search under Carroll versus the United States. The search is conducted, and the weapon is found in the console, and the ammunition clip is found on the floor by his feet. It seems to me a reasonable conclusion that a fact finder could draw is that if he's aware that there's marijuana in the console, it's a reasonable conclusion he's also aware of the other contents of the console, namely the handgun, which is certainly a lot more visible and larger than the quantity of marijuana that was found, and certainly the ammunition clip by his foot, you know, he should have been reasonably aware of. So given all of that, circumstantially, it seems to me there's enough evidence here that would warrant a fact finder drawing a conclusion that, you know, we'd be bound by, isn't there?
I would disagree, Your Honor, on a number of grounds. First of all, the court is correct that the appellant did say there was marijuana in the center console. However, no marijuana was found in the center console.
Doesn't matter.
Correct,
if he said it was there and the police officer, you know, then used that as the basis for the search, then the suggestion is that he's aware of the contents of the console.
And this was also a two-level console, Your Honor. It's fairly clear from the record that that's what it was.
What about the comment when asked about whether there were weapons? He said, I'm not sure.
Well, Your Honor, I think that actually goes to the fact that he didn't know it was there. If he specifically said, no, there are no weapons, then he would have had to have gone through all of the compartments of the vehicle and been aware of all the contents, and then that would have been a falsehood. The statement of I'm not sure is clearly an equivocation because he doesn't know.
What do we draw from the clip at his feet, though, that's in plain view?
So he may have been aware that there was a clip at his feet. However, typically, clips and firearms are kept together. It's entirely reasonable to believe that he knew the clip was there.
Could the fact finder have drawn anything from the fact that when the gun was tested, that the clip that was recovered was used?
That seems like too much of an inference to draw between the presence of the magazine and the firearm in and of itself.
Well, how about this inference then? If you know, wouldn't it be a reasonable inference, or couldn't it be a reasonable inference that when he's pulled over, he ejects the clip, sticks the gun in the console, and forgets where the clip went?
I suppose that's entirely possible, but we don't really have that many facts to point to that. We don't have.
No, but I mean, if the notion is that the clips, you know, ammunition clips are typically kept in the gun, I mean, otherwise it's a pretty useless gun. Then, you know, and it takes an affirmative act to eject the clip, to either reload it or for whatever reason. And the gun and the clip are now found separately, one in plain view, one in a console, which he's indicated he's at least aware of some of the contents of. I mean, those are, you know, it seems to me there's some rational conclusions that could be drawn from that.
Not specifically those, Your Honor, because there was ammunition that was also found in the top level of the console, so it doesn't make hardly any sense that there would be the magazine at his feet, one round of ammunition in the top level of the console, and then the actual firearm in the lower level of the center console. That just belies common sense with regards to how...
It doesn't belie common sense if you happen to know your way around firearms. If I unload a 9mm weapon by racking back the slide, it's going to eject the round that's in the chamber, which would certainly account for the single round that was found in the console, and eject the clip, which then drops out and could, you know, gravity takes over from there. It's found at his feet. And then the gun, which is now unloaded and the slide rack back, is found in the console. That totally explains the evidence in this case, doesn't it?
Well, there was no evidence that the gun was found with the slide rack back, and also the fact that the round was found on the top level does not... The physics just don't make sense there. Both levels would have to have been open, and it would have... If going by what the court is suggesting, the chain of events that may have occurred, it would make more sense that the round of ammunition was found in the lower level.
Isn't possession a constructive? It could be constructive possession, correct?
It has to be constructive possession.
So obviously, circumstantial evidence, as Judge Humphreys has noted in his hypothetical, could have been considered by the trier of fact.
I might also note that on page 158, 159, the evidence says that Officer Grant found the handgun with the slide in the open position.
Yes.
To me, that suggests that the round had been ejected.
Did the court say 158 and 159?
158, 159.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I am not seeing that on mine.
Joint appendix. I'm not sure if you look at the transcript. I have it as joint appendix pages 158 to 159.
That's exactly what I'm looking at, Your Honor.
I think it's in the Commonwealth's brief. I don't know which page, but I agree with Judge Humphrey's recollection, and if not actually reading of the transcript, that piece of evidence is in the case.
Then
where it is, I couldn't tell you.
I'm not sure it's a deal breaker either way, no. But nonetheless, it's, you know, it's a fact that whether the round is, you know, whether the slide is open or closed, it certainly the single round is consistent with having once been in the weapon and been removed in some way, shape, or form.
And on the issue of evidence, though, then this may not be a deal breaker, but I can't find any evidence that says a magazine is commonly kept together with the firearm. Well, that's what you said, but where does that come from?
Well, I think that's a matter of common knowledge.
I think it's commonly kept in the firearm.
Yes, Your Honor.
I would not know that. That would not be a piece of...
I mean, my experience with firearms, to the extent, I'm obviously not a witness in this case, but I mean, anybody who has any experience is going to conclude that, you know, when you have a magazine that's loaded, it's kept in the gun, otherwise the gun is pretty useless, and you take the magazine out for one of two purposes, either to store the gun or to reload the magazine.
But his argument is not about how to use a gun and how to properly use a gun. His argument is that it's evidence that he didn't know the gun was there, circumstantial evidence.
Correct, Your Honor.
But there was no evidence that they're commonly held together. Is that's not what you know. It's not, well, if you're going to shoot it, it's got to be held within the gun. So I don't think it's in the case.
Judge, if I may reserve the remainder of my time,
sure.
I have 50 seconds left.
I'll give you a couple of minutes because we beat you up a little bit there.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Jones. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm John Jones on behalf of the Commonwealth. And we are asking the court to affirm the conviction of Mr. Thomas because both of his assignments of error are without merit. So on the sufficiency issue, I think that the court's demonstrated a As already mentioned, a lot of the factors that went towards supporting the jury's conclusion that the gun was constructively possessed by Mr. Thomas. I would note that I think, Judge Humphreys, you mentioned this, but that constructive possession is largely a factual issue, and it's from Smallwood and Ritter. Obviously, the standard review is not whether the appellate court would find the evidence sufficient beyond reasonable doubt, but whether any rational fact finder could. And obviously, this fact finder, this jury, did find as such, and it was supported by several factors that the courts have discussed in constructive possession cases. So the fact that he was the sole occupant of the vehicle is certainly very probative. His proximity to both the gun and the magazine, mentioned in the appendix at 148 to 150 and then 177 to 178, the magazine being, quote, in plain view between Thomas's feet and the floorboard would suggest that he had knowledge and control over that. Discussed some about his statements to the officer about what was in the center console. One thing I don't think got brought up was the fact that he actually, after saying, there is marijuana in the console, he reached for the center console, and the officer had to stop him. And then when they searched the console, there was no marijuana inside the console. And it was very clear from the record, but there was a gun in the console, and there was one bullet inside the part of the console. And I don't think that is something that the jury had to consider in isolation and just credit his statement that I don't know if there are weapons here and his as being truthful. I actually think that the jury, it was a reasonable inference for the jury to draw that he was lying and dissembling about the gun because he knew it was there and that he was taking one of several potential bad acts in reaching towards the console. The jury didn't have to presume that was an innocent action in light of all the other evidence tending to show that he had knowledge and control over that firearm. I think that Thomas's position seeks to sort of isolate and atomize the different circumstances and say, well, that circumstance isn't enough, standing alone to establish constructive possession, and neither is that one, neither is that one. But that's not the way the test works. It's a totality analysis and the totality of all the evidence taken together.
To exercise dominion and control, which is what constructive possession is, you have to be aware of it, obviously.
Yes.
You can't exercise dominion and control over something that you're not aware of. And the question is whether there's any circumstantial evidence in this case that would suggest, and obviously the jury was satisfied there was enough to suggest that he was aware of the fact that the weapon was there and he could have therefore exercised dominion and control over it.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, specifically to the awareness, you have the magazine to the gun between his feet in plain view again.
Well, Mr. Jones, what about counsel's argument that maybe that gives you possession of the ammunition, but not necessarily of the weapon? I think that was the whole point of him saying, look, the way that it's stored is not common. And let's suppose for purposes of this question that that's a general point that people know about in terms of how ammunition and weapons are stored.
Your Honor, I think just straight up, if he knew that those were bullets in a magazine and he is charged with knowledge of those, I think it's a reasonable inference, and I think we get that on appeal, that he is probably more sure than not that there is probably a gun somewhere.
Well, because he's not charged as possessing ammunition as a... Actually, this is a delinquency in terms of not being past 29 by being convicted of a conviction that would be equivalent to a felony. But he's actually charged specifically with a gun, so I think counsel's point is perhaps there's enough for the ammunition, but there are leaps that are having to be made for the gun.
If you take the ammunition, again, in isolation, that may be a valid argument, but I think in context of the totality of the evidence, including his assertion that he had knowledge of what was in the center console, in fact, factually inaccurate description of that.
Well, this may be a segue into the other assignment of error, but as I gather from this record, there's really no clear evidence as to the ownership of the vehicle, correct?
No, Your Honor.
So the jury could conclude circumstantially that it's his vehicle, or at least he was operating it with the owner's permission, and was more likely than not aware of the contents of the vehicle.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, and I think that the fact that he was the sole occupant also bolsters that as a reasonable inference that the jury could have made. And if, you know, I could take the opportunity to segue into the other assignment of error, I think that there are several issues with Thomas's approach to that assignment of error. Obviously, the first thing in my brief, and I think the threshold question, is that there were two alternative rationales enunciated by the trial judge for why he was finding it inadmissible. First, there was speculation, so there was a foundation problem. Because the officer just, whenever they did the proffer, he didn't have personal knowledge of who
owned it. And he also didn't know the, is it fair to say that the basis was he also didn't know the source of the information?
Yes, Your Honor, and that goes to, you know, potentially his police report, the portion that dealt with ownership, could have been read in the record if he at one time had personal knowledge of the fact but had forgotten under 28035, but that wasn't raised at trial. It hasn't been raised on appeal, so that is not, you know, before this court.
Well, maybe
I think it's meritless because I don't think that they could have made the threshold showing that he once had personal knowledge given what he did recall, or rather what he did.
Maybe I'm misremembering, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought he indicated that he learned from somewhere, he could not remember where, of the ownership status of the vehicle. Is that, so at least he was aware of it in the abstract, but from sources unknown. So I'm not sure speculation is the proper, frankly, is the proper objection, because he's not speculating. He's not basically pulling it out of the air and saying, I don't know, but I think it's him. That's speculation. He's saying, I learned it. I don't remember where I learned it, but, you know, I have knowledge as to ownership that I got from somewhere else, which I think is more the hearsay objection, frankly.
I think that at the front line it is a hearsay objection, and that's why it arose in the context that it did with the objections. But I think that if your only basis for knowledge is a hearsay source, I don't know that you can say that you have personal knowledge of that fact that you're trying to testify.
Well, not having personal knowledge doesn't necessarily mean you're speculating. It seems to be speculation springs from whole cloth in your head as opposed to, you know, from...
Speculate. You're right, Your Honor. You're right. I guess I was maybe confusing in terms of...
I'm not sure it's a road we even need to go down. It strikes me, and maybe you can comment on it, strikes me that if we were to adopt your opponent's position with respect to admitting these sorts of public records through this mechanism, we don't even need the public record exception to the hearsay rule.
It certainly would have the potential to swallow the public records exception rule. I think that's very, well, I don't want to compliment or patronize it, but you know what I mean. I agree. And the other aspect of it is, I think that if the shoe was on the other foot with the facts of this case, or the posture, and if the Commonwealth was trying to say that the results of an officer's investigation are admissible no matter what the source of the individual fact he's trying to testify to, I think that there would be justified opposition to that, because, I mean, it would open up the floodgates to officers to testify to basically anything and not even have to say how they found out. As a result of my investigation, I just don't think it's a tenable...
Well, it certainly cuts out on the number of witnesses we ever need in any criminal trial by a drastic amount. So.
And gives a lot of the resulting burden to the officers, and not burden in, like, a bad way, you know, for prosecution's sake, but I think that it would really shift things if this was the state of the law. And you know, the court also already touched on the harmless error aspect to that evidentiary ruling, but I would call the court's attention to the standard review on evidentiary matters such as this. The trial court has broad discretion on admissibility of evidence, and in order to find error in the trial court's ruling on this issue, you have to find that reasonable jurists could not differ. And that there's not a clear error of law to get them around that to show an abuse of discretion. So I don't think that the trial court erred by any means in its evidentiary ruling. But for all the reasons stated, and for those in my brief, we have to see the rest of my time. If the court doesn't have any further questions, we'd ask that you would affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Anderson, I'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, from earlier, where the court was talking about whether or not the slide was forward or back, I'm looking where it says the officer said the slide was forward. Moving on to the public records exception to the rule, well, the defendant is protected by the Sixth Amendment. The Commonwealth is not. So it wouldn't really swallow the public records exception when being offered against the defendant because of the fact that we do have the Confrontation Clause. In this case, the Commonwealth would have perfectly been able to have cross-examined the officers to the source, and then that would have been an issue of weight, which is kind of tied into...
Now, how are they cross-examining their own witness, counsel?
Or directly examine the witness with regards... But that goes more to weight rather than admissibility. So if there are no further questions, Your Honor.
Let me just, in fairness, put it to you. Why would we even need a public records exception to the hearsay rule if we adopt your theory of getting this evidence in? We just ask the police officer about any public record, and you know, that they found in the course of their investigation.
Judge, again, we have the Confrontation Clause, so there is an intersection between both the public exception, the public records exception, and the Confrontation Clause.
So, is the answer to my question that we don't need the public records exception anymore?
Well, the reason why we have the public records exception is because it is a certain level of reliability that the courts have laid out, and there's certainly the tests that we can go through, and that's also kind of what we have here. It's not, again, my position is that this is not hearsay, but this would not necessarily swallow the public records exception because of the interplay between the Sixth Amendment.
But if it's not hearsay, if the officer learns of it from some third, fourth, or fifth party, then, the public records exception is what it sounds like, an exception to the hearsay rule. But if it's not, if we don't need it because the officer can just testify to what he learned indirectly from whatever source for the same information, then doesn't that, as Mr. Jones suggested, doesn't that swallow the exception?
Again, no, Your Honor, because of the whole Sixth Amendment play between...
Maybe I'm not understanding how the Sixth Amendment plays into that. But.
So certainly we have the ability to confront the witnesses against the defendant. The Commonwealth does not have
the witness on the stand is the police officer. You're certainly confronting him, but the information that he's testifying, that you want him to testify to, is not information from him. It's information from some other source.
If that information is indeed testimonial, but in this case, it's not testimonial.
How, counsel, is that not testimonial?
Well, Judge, the case that I cite as well is the Wimbish case with regards to the data that is given through a intoxilizer. It's not a...
Not to interrupt you, if I understand correctly, the reason why that's not testimonial is because there's a machine spitting it out. And here, what we know is the information about the ownership was given one of two ways, either by dispatch, which I would assume is a person, or by the owner of the car. So how is that not testimonial?
Well, I don't think it's by the owner of the car. I think it's by the registration.
Let me help
you
with that, because I don't think it's testimony, to be honest with you, because the definition of testimonial is whether it's gathered for use in a criminal proceeding, and vehicle ownership is typically not gathered exclusively for use in a criminal proceeding.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that was the ruling in the Wimbish
case. But if
case.
That's the case, the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply at all, period. Zip, nada. So if that's the case, then we're back to a hearsay analysis.
And again, Your Honor, it's our position that this is not a hearsay.
I understand your position. I just don't understand if you understand the consequences of your position, which would be that a very large exception to the hearsay rule basically becomes what amounts to a nullity.
Not in the context of a criminal case being offered against the defendant, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate it. We'll come down to Greek counsel and then take up the next case.